You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. But today is all about the power of words. The language we use to describe food can be incredibly powerful. Words on labels and packaging can put ideas into our minds, change expectations, and actually change our eating experience. Get the beautiful, beguiling description right, it can do wonderful things for your brand. Get it wrong, and the consumer's experience may well be ruined. The question is, what works and what doesn't? Should crisps be described as salty, fresh or crunchy? Will the phrase plant-based always conjure up positive associations? Well, with me is someone who's delved deep into our brains to find the answers. Christopher T. Simons, Associate Professor in Sensory Science at Ohio State University. Hello there, Christopher.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we get into the detail of your work, let's just start off with a few duff calls. What's the most off-putting food description you've ever seen?
Off-putting food descriptions, yeah. So for me, the most off-putting food descriptions tend to be those that describe these fermented, sort of rotten types of products, right?
So hard to get that one right, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what you can do with those, but people eat them, so I...
Yeah, it's true. It's like you're just changing expectations, which I guess is what the important thing is. So let me hand over to you. Tell us all about the study that you've been working on, about cookies, I believe, and associated language with that. What did you investigate? What did you discover?
Yeah. So my lab is actually really interested in context in general. And so there's a variety of ways that you can manipulate context and how context then shapes people's expectations. We've done a variety of experiments using virtual reality to recreate scenarios that people consume foods in, and their preferred foods change. In this particular study, what we are looking at is kind of twofold. So one, we wanted to take advantage of a phenomenon called negativity bias. And so this is a bias that people have where negative sensations, negative experiences have bigger impact on our behaviors than positive experiences. And so we wanted to see if that was true as it relates to our perceptions of food and how that might then actually drive food choice and food liking and so forth. So in this particular study, we actually did it initially with crackers, so just the traditional saltine crackers. And then we did it again in cookies just to see if this effect was robust and could be really applied to all product types, or is it only really relevant for product types that are, you know, sort of maybe neutral. And what we did is actually really pretty straightforward and fairly simple manipulation. So we had people evaluate the same exact product. So for instance, with the crackers or the cookies, we took them out of exactly the same package and we placed them on a plate. One of the plates was labeled consumer complaint. The other second plate was labeled factory typical. And then the third was labeled new and improved. And we told the consumers that were coming in that we were working with a company, a partner, and they had a new and improved version, but they also had some versions of this cookie that had been receiving these consumer complaints, and they wanted to, you know, try to see some details related to that. Same exact cookie, right? No difference, taken out of exactly the same package, and people perceived them totally different. So not only what they perceived, so when it was labeled as consumer complaint, they noticed or identified attributes that are typically less desirable. So they referred to them as stale or burnt or not sweet enough or, you know, these types of things.
That is fascinating, isn't it?
Right. And they didn't like them as much. So liking was significantly less, right? So in our space, you know, a drop of liking of about 1 or 2 points is almost unheard of. And so this is just simply by labels, right? So how we had sort of primed them. Interestingly, when we looked at the effect of the new and improved, especially compared to the factory typical, we saw a slight bump. But this is sort of consistent with our hypothesis. So we sort of expecting the negativity bias to have that larger effect because it's more salient, right? Mm. With the positive effect, with this new and improved, people did start to notice, they claimed to identify attributes that were more positive, but their liking didn't improve dramatically.
But fascinating as well that you have a difference like that. So what's interesting to me here is we've got these concepts of cross-modal sensory perception where, you know, the sight of a food blends together with smell and taste, and so you can colour a white wine red and people will use the argot of red wine drinking to describe it. You can colour exactly the same liquid, different colours, and people will imagine that the orange one, it tastes slightly of orange and something like that. But this is different, isn't it? This is very much a psychological crossover. And why is that important?
Yeah. So I think it's important for a number of reasons. So one, we were interested in it from the perspective of, can we leverage this, can we utilize this from a product development perspective? So as companies are developing products are typically framed in a positive experience, right? So you talk to a food company and they're going to tell you they don't make bad products, right? I mean, that obviously they're not going to be in business. And generally speaking, when we eat food, it's a positive experience. Now, clearly there's, you know, conditions where people have negative sort of relationships with foods, but by and large, right, consumption of food and that relationship that we have with food is very positive. And so as a consequence, we have what, you know, we typically would sort of refer to as this positivity bias. And so when people are evaluating foods under that context, they're going to notice different things, right? They're going to sort of pay attention to different things. And so we were looking to see if, in fact, using this negativity bias, not only does it change what people perceive, but could you then leverage that and actually sort of develop products in a different way? So as opposed to trying to optimize those drivers of liking, maybe it's easier, maybe it's more effective to simply remove those taints that weren't particularly noticed under that positivity bias, right? But sort of a slight taint that if you notice when sort of cued or primed to be sensitive to it, that's what sort of impacts your liking, right? So if you can remove that, maybe that's going to have a bigger effect on product success.
Yeah. And have you got any examples of that sort of thing that you can tell us?
No. So this was really our first opportunity to sort of see this. So we actually have another paper that's coming out soon where we actually tested that hypothesis with chocolate milk. And so we actually with the study that we just completed, you may argue that, okay, it's the same products. People, did they really perceive the stale, right? Did they really perceive the negative attributes? Maybe they're, you know, identifying these quote unquote phantoms, right? So we wanted to see if actually this negativity bias could really actually bias people to be more sensitive to taints. And so we actually took chocolate milk and we salted it. So we put just a tiny amount of salt in it. So it wasn't overpowering, right? And in some of our testing before we actually executed the larger scale test, people would sort of identify it as, I can tell there's something going on there, but I couldn't really characterize it. So if we did the same thing, factory typical, consumer complaint, new and improved, under that consumer complaint label or negativity bias, people, especially when we actually combined it with implicit testing, so if we actually recorded people's facial expressions, they were much more sensitive to that salt and they expressed disgust much more readily. I mean, not high intensity, but you know, certainly that we could record. Under that negativity bias that they didn't express when it was either factory typical or new and improved. So it suggests that people really do become more sensitive to a taint that's actually there.
Yeah. Does it also suggest that we're generally negative buggers anyway?
Yes.
You know, that we just got to look for the worst, basically.
Yeah. So negativity bias is one of these phenomena that's sort of well established in psychology and well understood, and it has really clear adaptive value, right? If you pay attention more to negative stimuli, right, those typically, you know, when we were cave people, those were things that, you know, were likely going to cause death, right? And so if we are more sensitive to those, then it sort of allows us to avoid those situations and, you know, improves our likelihood for, you know, evolutionary success. So it does sort of make sense.
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, it's studied a lot in economics, you know, people. So for $100 reward versus $100 loss, like in a gambling test, people are much more sensitive to that $100 loss, right? That's way more impactful than winning $100. So it's sort of across the board.
Yeah. And so you've started with a very simple but crafty way to go about it. Can we delve deeper into it, though? Are there certain negative words that have a bigger impact on consumers? Is it words themselves or is it the concepts?
That's a really good question, and I'm not entirely sure. I think it probably depends on the person. What is negative to you may not be negative to me, right? I think there's probably also some cultural aspects to that as well. I think it also matters, especially as it relates to the positive influence, who's actually conveying that information, right? If it's somebody that you trust, right, that's much more impactful than somebody either that you don't trust or that you don't know. Yeah. I would also imagine, right, that words or labels that imply some sort of quote unquote harm are going to be much more impactful than words or phrases that maybe convey, especially personal harm, right, that convey maybe, I don't know, more esoteric types of negative effects, you know, climate damage or those types of things, right? Yeah. I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be looked at in that space to see what's driving those types of influences.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out the edition where we asked whether food health claims are confusing consumers. To find it, just search food health claims at foodmatterslive.com. And now, let's get back to the chat. Drawing on your work generally in sensory science, is this partly about the soundscape, the sound of words, the plosives and fricatives in a sentence? Or are we really looking here at conceptual psychological tools, you know, semantics and semiotics? And can you separate the two of them?
Good question. I think there's probably some link there. I think based on some of our other work that's not using necessarily words to frame the context of the reference, what I really think is going on is this phenomenon of priming, right? So I think how you prime somebody to be sensitive, that can be words, right? And I think the specific words, the way that words are said or the cadence that are connected with certain words or phrases, I would imagine that would certainly have some impact as well, right? But yeah, I think the word has to, or the scenario or whatever it has to, you know, whatever you're using to contextualize, I think it has to convey some meaning or some contextual element that the person is going to be responsive to. I mean, you know, brands, I mean, all of that, right? I mean, that's why marketing's so persuasive and so powerful, right? A brand, just an image, right? If you're a loyal brand user, that priming of that brand is going to make you much more sensitive to, to qualities of that product and so forth.
Mm. So the food industry is obsessed with its message. Exactly. As you say, marketing is a vast section of the industry, let alone making the food and selling it to people. So what do you think food manufacturers should take away from what you've learned?
You know, the food industry is, you know, they've become very successful at creating products that people want to eat, right? May not be the healthiest, right? And I think that's sort of the crux of the problem. Yeah. I don't think they've done it necessarily to be nefarious. I think they've created products that, you know, have high fat, high sugar, high salt because people like them and it sells, right? Mm. And when we were cave people, those were important sources of calories and, you know, mineral balance. And so, you know, we have these really strong innate desires to be, you know, consuming those types of foods. But I think the consumer and governments and health systems, right, are starting to recognize that, you know, these types of diets aren't healthy. And so how do we nudge people or how do we change people's behaviors in a way that they'll consume healthier foods, right? This could be one of those ways, right? So clearly there's already negative messaging around high fat, high food. I think people are still consuming those foods, right? But maybe, you know, combinations of messaging, both negative and positive messaging, can sort of nudge people into the direction of consuming healthier foods that, you know, ultimately have bigger impact on, you know, their own health status. Maybe the same thing could be said with sustainable and these types of things as well.
It also sort of points at difficulties as well, doesn't it? So I mean, there's, you know, language is dynamic, and the meaning behind words changes. So whereas salty used to be, you know, a lovely idea of, oh yes, I get the mineral sensation from that. Yeah. Salt is now a bad word. Sugar, you know, we used to have a brand called Sugar Puffs here. I'm not sure if it's the same in the US, but yeah. Sugar Puffs. Yeah. They're now not called Sugar Puffs anymore. They're called Honey Monster Puffs, I believe. And because the word sugar has a negative, you know, it has changed. It used to be the thing that you bought it for, and that's shifted. So how do marketing companies, I mean, do they just need to pay better writers? They need to research it? What can they do to use these tools?
The jury's still out. And I think the other thing, you know, human behavioral research is infinitely fascinating. I mean, every day, you know, I have conversations with my graduate students, and it's like, wow, I mean, I could have things to do for the rest of my life, right? Setting these things. It's just every day something new comes up. And I think one of the things that really underpins, especially human behavior as it relates to other, you know, animal behaviors, is that we're so unpredictable, right? So people will, you know, I use this slide in my class when we talk about sort of this unpredictability of humans, right? And so people will be taking the escalator up to Lifetime Fitness to go work out, right? I mean, it's just sort of inconsistent with what they're trying to do, right? And so the same thing in this space as well, right? So consumers will tell you they want low salt, they want low sugar, right? And so food companies are trying to respond to that. So here in the US, Campbell's Soup used to put low salt on the can, right? And after a while, that became a signal to consumers that low quality or tastes bad, right? So they took it off, right? And so now they're dropping salt levels in the soup without advertising it, because it became sort of, as you said, sort of this bad word, but from a different perspective, right?
And the word low equals bad. The semiotics again come into play.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really, this is the problem, right? What consumers tell you versus what their behaviors indicate are often at odds. And so from what I understand, the UK has actually been much better, especially at like salt reduction and so forth, because they've used sort of these quote unquote nudge types of principles, right?
There's been a lot of it about,
And I think that's kind of probably, you know, those types of things, right? Don't try to, you know, hit a home run right out of the, you know, shoot, but do things in a sort of consistent manner where you change people's expectations. And I think, you know, this work, you know, the labeling study that we did, I mean, it's all about expectation, right? And this is one of the things that is big in my lab, right? So how you prime somebody, whether it's a label or a specific scenario where people are consuming food, that prime sets up an expectation for a particular experience, right? So when I go to a fast food restaurant, I don't expect the hamburger to taste the same as it will at a five-star restaurant, right? If I don't sort of assess people's experiences in contexts that are relevant, then I'm going to be misled, right? And so sort of setting up these expectations can really guide people's behaviors.
So can you extrapolate from this, the idea that, that expectation can be guided? A lot of new challenger brands very much talk about their story, about this, you know, about their founders and things like that. And I guess in a sense that plays into exactly what you're saying. They are contextualizing, they're creating the framework within which you can then trust them. Now, there's a lot of words involved in this stuff. There's a lot of, and you, again, you can get that wrong. You can use the sort of slang that you think is going to be hit with the kids, and you can look like a complete tit. And so there are dangers in that, but because you are creating your own world within which that can work, presumably you're getting off on the right foot already?
Yes, presumably, right? If you get it right. If you get it wrong, obviously then you're getting off on the wrong foot. but I think that's exactly right. contextualizing and controlling the narrative such that people buy into your message, right? And your reason, right? So we often talk about product development efforts. So we have a course here that I teach, food product development. And so the first 4 weeks is really spent about identifying a consumer need, right? And then developing that product to answer that consumer need. And that's really, you know, that's the basis of product development, whether it's in food or phones or cars or anything else, right? You solve a consumer's need. And so if you can, one, understand what that consumer need is, and then articulate your messaging around how you're delivering against that need and all of the other components around it, right? So if it doesn't solve the consumer's need, they may try it the first time, right? But they're not going to come back and try it again, right? So that kind of has to be the key. But there's all of the other sort of ancillary components that build the story, that build the brand, that build the, you know, so here in the U.S., Impossible Foods, right, with plant-based meats, right? So really, when you listen to the owner and the founder of that company and you listen to the people that are affiliated with it, it's not about a healthier food product. It's all about sustainability. So if sustainability and global, you know, climate is an important concept, that message is really going to resonate with you, right? And then that's going to set up sort of certain, not only set certain expectations, but it's also going to, if the product isn't exactly meeting expectations, people will kind of give it a break, right? Because there's these other components to it that are important.
You're buying the sustainability and therefore a little bit of lack of flavor or texture.
Exactly. For me, they're a really fascinating company because as they move forward, right, and I would say all of these companies that are sort of in that space of plant-based foods, right, as they move forward, as they make them healthier, right, as they start to make them so that they have a better nutritional profile, right, it's probably going to decrease quality to some extent. And so what's the level of trade-off? So how far before consumers not willing to buy it.
Does it extend to crossovers with things like packaging design? I mean, at some point, a color doesn't feel right, doesn't feel like it fits, and with the words that have been spoken. I mean, ends up being so conceptual that it's hard for me to get my head around. But I mean, literally, the design of something might not fit with the words, and that's a difficult thing to try and regulate or to try and get right, isn't it?
You're totally right. And I think that's, you know, in a lot of these companies now, they're hiring, right, consumer psychologists and, you know, packaging designers to work together. I mean, I think here in the US, probably in the UK as well, you know, one of the things, I mean, a clear message, sort of color message, is green, that's related with sustainability, right? And so it's a very powerful, so if you had something that's bright red or, you know, I'm not sure that it would align as much, right? So I think there's definitely all of these sort of cross-modal interactions that reinforce messaging. I'm not aware of a lot of research that's been done specifically at looking at those alignments and the relationship, but certainly I think that it's really a key, right?
I mean, there's also the study of I think I've got this right, but synesthesia, which is where you imagine a date or a day of the week to be a certain color, and it's not that you kid yourself or you get it completely wrong and somebody says Wednesday and you're going orange. I don't know what Wednesday is. It's orange. But there is a connection between the two. And do you think that we all have that to some extent? That there's a little bit of color, sound, a bit of those things that do cross over into the psychology side of it.
100%. I think 100%. There's these associations. I think there's true synesthetes that essentially the wiring in the brain is sort of different, right? And so when they see a color, they sort of perceive it as a smell or a word or something like that, right? So that's hard to wrap my head around. Right. I mean, that's just fundamentally they perceive the world differently. Right. But that's not what we're talking about. Right. I think all of us do have these associations. It's probably through experience. There's probably some that are stable. Right. That may be cross cultures. But I think there's a lot of learning that takes place that reinforces those things over time. Color's an interesting one. Right. Because, again, like you alluded to it in the introduction and you had mentioned orange and the, you know, it really conveys the sensation and the expectation that the product's going to taste like an orange beverage. Right. So in the U.S., orange, purple. Right. Those have very strong flavor connotations. Mm. Red, what's red, right? Could be strawberry, could be cranberry, could be raspberry, right? So it's that connection's not nearly as strong. Mm. And these are also cultural. So in other parts of the country, right, where maybe they don't have access to grape juice or orange juice or whatever, you know, they don't have those same sorts of connections, which is quite interesting. But it's also really interesting because those color connections are so strong. So we actually published a study a number of years ago where you can manipulate the flavor that's associated with that color, and people are willing to suspend their acceptance until it gets way, you know, incongruent, right? So you can flavor, for instance, an orange colored drink with pineapple or, you know, something like that, and people will say, oh, it's not the best orange, but it's okay. You know, it's an orange drink, right? It's not until you start flavoring it with chicken or mint that they're like, oh my God, this is terrible, right? So it's such a strong cue that people will suspend their experiences and their perceptions to align with that experience or with that expectation. So it's fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, this is an extraordinary field, and I love the fact that there are so many kind of touch points that where these things interrelate. But just tell us a bit about what's next for you. What are you looking at in the Sensory Science Lab, and what's getting you excited?
Yeah. So we've got a couple of big areas that we're really interested in. So I alluded to it earlier, using virtual reality and immersive technologies to recreate sort of conceptually or contextually relevant scenarios and see how that changes people's not only liking but perceptions. So what people perceive is also sort of dependent on the environment that they're evaluating the food product, who they're with. So this is important for a couple of reasons. So in our data or in our studies, we typically see when we test people in contextually relevant environments, our methods are more predictive, their liking's more stable across individuals, so we have better reliability in our data source. So as a product developer, that's really important, right? If I can be more certain that the products that I'm gonna launch are gonna be those ones that are, you know, liked in the future, that's good to know. Mm. But what we've also found, and I alluded to this earlier as well, is that people's preferences and their sort of optimal profile changes depending on the scenarios in which they're evaluating the foods, right? So to test in a single scenario, so for instance, we typically test in a sterile booth, right? So we stick somebody in a closet and we, you know, open this sliding window, and these two gloved hands push these, you know, plastic cups of yogurt through, often under red light, right? So ecological validity is so low. It's no wonder that, you know, the data that we collect in those types of environments don't really recapitulate, because we don't eat in closets, you know, under red light.
Speak for yourself.
So if we can improve those methods, then I think there's big advantage there. One of the things that we started to look at as well is it sort of relates to human behavior. So when we test in these immersive environments, you know, we see these improved methodologies. We see that people's preferences and what they're seeking out as a preferred product sort of changes. So part of that, we think, is due to context, but some of that also is just because when people come into these environments, they become a much more engaged panelist. Okay. So compared to a booth, a virtual environment is much more engaging. And so one might argue that the improved data quality is due to just a more engaged panelist. So we started to really get interested in engagement. And so we've developed a whole series of experiments looking at engagement. We've developed a tool now that we can measure engagement. We know the sort of the factors that are contributing to engagement in these types of studies. And we can see with relatively simple manipulations to quote unquote traditional sensory types of testing, consumer testing, we can manipulate the level of engagement that the consumer or that the panelist has. Yeah. Very simple thing, just giving people sort of the context of why their data is important. You know, so we often don't do that, right? We try to keep everything behind this veil because we don't want to bias them, right? But if you say, hey, you know what, your data are going to be really important. This company is using this data to, you know, improve this product, and they really want your information, and it'll be key in sort of how they, you know, move forward. Just that simple message not forces, but invites the panelists to be much more thoughtful, much more engaged, right? So we're really interested in engagement. And so between context, so we can manipulate engagement via context, but we're also now starting to look at embedding gamification elements into our testing designs as well. And so, you know, my son will play a video game for all day if I let him, right? So they figured it out, right? They figured out how to keep people engaged. And so we're looking at ways that we can sort of quote unquote gamify our paradigms in a way that panelists, it's not necessarily fun, but they're engaged, right? I mean, certainly fun is an element to games, but there's a lot more to it. And
And for anyone who's listening who's thinking, what hell are they talking about? if you ever do these sensory perception, food testing and food tasting experiences, they're really quite grim. Yeah. You know, as you say, every bit of sensory distraction is removed, which means that you're in often in a completely white room. You can't see the person giving you the food. It is, you know, it does take away all distractions, but it also is not a very normal way to eat. Exactly. And so I think you're absolutely right. It's, you know, to give some sort of context, but then what's the context? There could be 20 different contexts, and maybe that's what you need to
exactly
to test.
And that's exactly you should come visit my lab. That's exactly what we're doing. So I think you hit it right on the head, right? So your context may be different from mine, but that's where virtual reality really comes in, you know, because we can now take cameras, right, and people can film, you know, if they eat whatever crackers or cookies in their living room, they can film their living room for, you know, 5 minutes, bring it to us. We put it into our system, and now you're evaluating cookies in your living room, right?
And if you're reading a packet, and what you can see is a version of a supermarket shelf or shelves complete with other products, your reading of one packet when there are with a lot of other distractions around may be completely different. And that is fascinating.
Yeah.
And I guess people will pay good money for that,
we hope
Chris.
So.
You've got your head screwed on there. Excellent. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for your time and for your expertise.
It's really been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Christopher T. Simons, Associate Professor in Sensory Science at Ohio State University. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Table Talk. We've got hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. For instance, if you search Flavor, Is It All in the Mind? You'll get the episode where we look into the history of taste and flavor and the tricks that food companies use. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.